Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. I'm Craig Garber, host of the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. What you may not know about me is that I'm also the author of the book, How to Make Maximum Money with Minimum Customers. And since March of 2000, I've been running a busy marketing consulting firm. During this time, I've helped over 300 clients in 108 different industries all over the world sell everything from $20 books to $5,000 seminar seats and everything in between. Now, if you own or operate a business, ask yourself the following marketing-related questions and be brutally honest with your answers. Do you have an email list of prospects and customers, but you have no idea what to say to them, how often to say it, or how to make money with this list? Is your business website consistently generating new leads and making sales? Is it making you any money at all? If not, do you know why? Is your advertising effective? Is it consistently making you money? And do you know how to use social media effectively to market your business? If any one of these questions are puzzling you, then you need to book a one-on-one marketing strategy session with me if your business qualifies. After this strategy session, you'll know how to speak to and make money with your email list, how to use your website to attract customers and clients who are ready to buy from you now, and how to sell your goods and services for top dollar and at much higher profit margins than your competition. Listen, stop hoping things will get better on their own. Hope is not a very good business strategy. Instead, book a marketing strategy session with me by going to everyonelovesguitar.com/marketing and find out if your business meets the five criteria you need to qualify for this service. Again, that's everyonelovesguitar.com/marketing. Thank you for listening, and now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I am with an absolutely monster blues player today. He's just, well, you got to listen to him. I'm with the one and only Lance Lopez, and he's got a great story of success and, you know, rags to riches and redemption, and he's just full of good stuff. So let me tell you a little bit about Lance. He's born in Shreveport, Louisiana, and his upbringing was filled by music. He absorbed all the Louisiana roots, heritage, and culture all around him as a child, started playing guitar at age 8, and was completely self-taught. When he was 12, he moved to Dallas to live with his mom. Just 2 weeks after moving to Dallas, he saw B.B. King and Stevie Ray Vaughan jam together at Stevie's last concert ever in Dallas, which prompted Lance to make the blues his passion for the rest of his life. At 14, he moved back to New Orleans to live with his dad, and in New Orleans, he began playing professionally in and around the French Quarter. After a brief stint down here in Southwest Florida, Lance moved back to Dallas with his family, where he's lived ever since. Upon moving back to Dallas at age 16, he struck up a friendship and mentorship with Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top and some other Texas blues greats who began really helping him shape and mold his sound and guitar style. At 17, he was hired by R&B soul legend Johnny Taylor, and he toured as his guitarist all over the southern United States on the legendary Chitlin' Circuit as his guitarist. A year later, at 18, he was hired by Lucky Peterson, and he toured all over the world with him for 3 years. During his time with Lucky Peterson, he also did a couple of brief stints as a guitarist for one of the many versions of the Buddy Miles Express. What a good experience that must have been. In 1999, Lance started his solo career, and he began touring locally and regionally, opening up shows for B.B. King and other legends. When he was 23, he went to Europe on his first solo tour in 2000 and 2001 after getting his name out there and getting known in the European market by being a member of that Lucky Peterson band. He released 4 small-budget studio albums from 1999 to 2007 on an indie label based in Rochester, New York, called Grooveyard Records. Buddy Miles produced his first album, and in 1999, Lance produced all the other albums himself. And he also collaborated with Doug Pinnick from King's X and Eric Gales on his second album, 2004 release, Wall of Soul. Between 2008 and 2011, Lance began touring Europe again, and he began to play bigger festivals, and he toured with large rock acts like ZZ Top, Whitesnake, Def Leppard, and Rod Stewart. He stunned audiences worldwide with his fiery brand of Texas blues rock and powerhouse performances. He won over the likes of guitar legends like Jeff Beck, Johnny Winter, Billy Gibbons, B.B. King, and Eric Clapton, who are not only all personal friends of Lance's, but fans. In 2009, Lance signed with MIG, which is Made in Germany Music, String Commander in Hanover, Germany, and he did 2 albums and a live concert D from the German TV show Rock Palace with them. Now, and if you are listening to this and you've never heard of Rock Palace, go check them out. Anybody that's a good guitar player has been on that show. I mean, you look at, they got Roy Buchanan. Just everybody's been on there. I mean, everybody. Both those albums were produced by Jim Gaines and were recorded at Arden Studios down in Memphis. Handmade Music was released this past March 2002. He's got an album out now called Live in New York City, and we're going to talk about that. That's on Cleopatra Records, and he's putting the finishing touches on his next studio album, both of which were produced by Johnny Winter guitarist and Grammy-winning artist and producer Paul Nelson, who was actually on, I interviewed Paul earlier this week, and he's in episode 133. And if you haven't heard that show, I encourage you to check it out. I listened to Lance's new album, Live in New York. It's freaking amazing. It's like very hardcore Texas blues, highly rocked out. His voice is incredibly powerful. Dude, I would not want to be your son, because if you got angry at me, I would shit myself. And he sings... He sings like he wants you to get out of the way, man. This is fiery shit. And he plays guitar for dear life on every song. And that's my words, not some PR company. And he's really blistering hot on all the solos. On top of that, the production on the album is amazing. I would never, ever even think it was recorded live. It sounds like a studio recording. I mean, the mix in the engineering is incredibly clear. So that being said, Lance, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate your time.
Greg, thank you so much for having me, man. Wow, what an intro. A lot of that stuff reminded me of a bunch of things I'd forgotten.
Well, that's good, man. A lot of people say that. I think, you know, when you're so busy, you just run. Yeah. It's like just the next thing and the next thing. It's not, you know, but when you right. have a time to listen to all this shit, it's like, wow, that's pretty decent.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So well, let me ask you. Oh, you're welcome, man. You're a great guitar player. I really like your stuff. I'm a blues guy, so. In your bio, it said when you were 16, you met Billy Gibbons and some other Texas guys. How'd you wind up meeting Billy and all these other guys?
Well, you know, like you'd read there, we were living in Florida, Southwest Florida, and man, it was great. You know, living in Florida during high school, and I was down there in between Fort Myers and Tampa, you know, down around Sarasota and Venice Beach and all that. And we were always running over and surfing on the East Coast at Melbourne and Cocoa Beach and all that. It was a great time. And then we moved back to Texas, and I did a lot of playing down in Florida too, which I cut my teeth in so many of those places down there and had so much fun. And then we moved back to Texas. And when we moved back, I was just so in this big, at that time too, I was so into Jimi Hendrix and Cream and all the great music. And I had gone to a blues jam at a place called the Greenville Bar and Grill. I got back to Dallas and everybody was telling me, man, you got to go down to this place called the Greenville Bar and Grill. And it was on Greenville Avenue in Dallas, and which is where like a lot of the premier restaurants and bars, big bar scenes, like, you know, it's like a local strip thing. And so this Greenville Bar and Grill was a big kind of A-list hang in Dallas. You always had movie stars and musicians and a lot of those kind of people hanging there if they were in Dallas, if they were in town. And so there was a big blues jam there. And so I was invited out, and they said, man, you got to come down to this blues jam. So next door to the Greenville Bar and Grill was an Italian restaurant called Torelli's. And it was a very premier, world-class Italian restaurant. Well, I got up at this blues jam. I was invited to the blues jam, and I got up with my little Stratocaster and played a complete set of all Hendrix songs. You know, I did the whole bit, did the Foxy Lady, Purple Haze, you know, Voodoo Child's Haze, you know, all that stuff. Did the whole, like, Jimi Hendrix medley. And so Billy Gibbons was next door having dinner. And he heard, like, through the wall, he was like, man, somebody's over there playing Jimi Hendrix. And finished his dinner and came over. And as soon as I came off the stage, the manager, it was my first time ever being in this place too, mind you. I mean, I never had set foot in this place. And I came off the stage and the manager grabbed me and said, there's somebody back here that wants to meet you in the back of the club, and took me back there. And Billy was standing there waiting, you know, and course, seeing him, you know, it was like, wow, immediately. I mean, he's very recognizable if you see Billy.
Sure.
So I saw him standing in the back of the room, and it was just, you know, it was very cool. And Billy was living in downtown Dallas. And this is when they had just, ZZ Top had just signed with BMG. They just left Warner Brothers and signed with, and so they put out the string of 90s albums starting with Antenna. So they were still, you know, that's when they had Pincushion was out. So they still were very much in MTV mode, and Pincushion was a big video on MTV right then at that time. So, you know, so it was really cool to hang with Billy and hang out at his loft down in Deep Ellum and ride around in the Cadillac around Deep Ellum and around Dallas. And, you know, he was always pulling up to all the blues jams or whatever, and he'd be like, hey, man, hop in, let's go hang. So, you know, it was really, really cool to be around Billy at that time and really to, you know, get that kind of education.
What would you say, was there like one or two things specifically that you could recall that you learned from him, either about performing, playing, or life in general, or even the business of music?
Well, it was always about, with Billy, it was always, and still is today, it's always about looking to the future, you know? And I think that's one of the things why he developed such a relationship with me and kind of realized that, you know, this thing has to continue and, somebody has to continue it. And there's a complete a lineage of it, especially coming from Texas in that style of music. And it was always about, because, you know, I was so transfixed on the past and, you know, you hear a lot of people that say, oh man, I love this era of ZZ Top, but I really don't particularly care. You know, a lot of people say the quote unquote new ZZ Top or whatever. And so that was always a discussion that we had. And it was always about staying relevant and staying in the future and, moving forward and not backward. You know, and that was always, because I listened to all old music. You know, I always stayed in the past, and especially with the blues and everything else. But, you know, I love all the old records from Zeppelin and Sabbath and, you know, all the old British blues guys, Cream, you know, and everything else. And that was always a conversation that we had. It was always like, you got to keep moving forward and staying relevant and moving into the future as opposed to looking backward. And then it was just a matter of, you know, play what you want to hear, you know, play what you want to hear and make it your own, you know? So those were the things that always really stood out in my mind, and the most important is that tone is in your hands, you know, tone is in your hands, and it's not about, you know, first, yeah, you have certain tools that help you get those tones, but you got to have it in your hands first before you can make any kind of other piece of gear translate your sound.
You mean if I buy a Hendrix fuzz pedal, I won't sound like Jimmy?
I mean, maybe.
But maybe not. So those are good. Okay, so I think those are three really good points. Look to the future always. Play what you want to hear, and tone is in your hands. Man, those are really, I wrote that down. That's really good stuff. When you were in Southwest Florida, did you any chance run into John Prestia?
No, that name is real familiar, though.
He had a band called Pirate, and he might have left Southwest Florida before then. He was like in Sarasota area.
Yeah, this was early 90s, so.
Yeah, he might have just left for Nashville right when you came down there, but he was all over there. He's.
I remember Dan Kohler and Chris Anderson and all those guys, Les Dudek. And,
right.
Those were then Derek Trucks. I mean, me and Derek were playing all those when we were kids. You know, we were playing a lot of those rooms together. You know, Skippers and Gators and all.
Skippers right down the block from me, man.
Gators. I don't know if Gators is even still around anymore. No. But there was a lot of those places. I think Gators was in Brandon, maybe.
Yeah, then it might be. I don't know. I don't know the clubs down there, but Skippers is, you know, 4 miles away from me, man. That's quite
right.
Funny. Yeah,
I hope to play there again soon someday, man. I miss that funky joint, man. It was cool.
Yeah,
and then Ybor City. You know, we used to play in Ybor City all the time at the old Blues Ship. There used to be an old club there called the Blues Ship. You know, and there was, oh man, yeah, the old Ybor City days, man.
Very cool. Yeah, so at this point, like when you're 18 already, you've had a shit ton of experience on the road. And then you decide you're going to go do Europe on your own.
Mm-hmm.
I think that took a lot of balls and confidence, man. And I give you a lot of credit for doing that. And I was curious what was going through your mind as you made the decision to do that. And can you maybe talk about that experience in general?
Yeah. I mean, I'd been playing behind a lot of guys, man. You know, I'd been playing, like you read there. You know, when Johnny Taylor hired me, I not only, you know, I officially say Johnny, but I bounced around. You know, there was times when we would back, you know, when our band would show up and we'd be there with Johnny, but there'd be four or five other guys on the bill and we would have to back all these different singers and stuff, you know, like review style, you know.
Mm.
So I played behind a lot of guys like Bobby Bland, Bobby Blue Bland, you know, and Johnny Guitar Watson and a lot of other people. And, you know, man, that was it was a hard school to come from, man, you know, and, you know, a lot of those guys were, you know, they were getting high and it was really crazy. And, you know, it was the whole fact of, hey, man, if you want to hang, you know, kind of thing. And that was a lot for, you know, me at that age, man,
yeah.
17, 15 years old. It was a lot to kind of deal with, man. And, but you know, hey, I wanted to hang, you know, it's like I was a kid and I wanted to hang and I wanted to sound like these guys. So it was really daunting. And then, you know, it was from that school where, you know, you had to, if you missed a note, you got fined, man. You know, if you messed up on stage and messed up, man, they would take your whole, you know, half your pay or maybe all your pay. So it really kind of kept you on your, so it was really daunting, man, considering all the things involved. And, you know, I kind of ended up bouncing back and forth, between a lot of different R&B and soul people. And I first went to Europe at 18 with Lucky Peterson, you know, and I went out with Lucky and Lucky really featured me. And so that really opened the door for Europe for me. You know, it really opened the door to Mass. And not only that, but to different promoters and different people would see me playing as Lucky's guitar player. Because Lucky was at that time, he was a major star there. I mean, he's still very well known in Europe. But at that time, I mean, we were playing arenas. And I mean, I thought I was going over with a blues guy. We were just going to play blues clubs. And we were playing, you know, amphitheaters and arenas and big halls. And I had no idea what scale and what level Lucky Peterson was on in Europe. And so
and compensation wise, was he paying you like you were playing in blues clubs, or was he paying you like,
oh,
you?
No. And the money was really good.
Oh, okay. So he took good care of you.
Yeah.
Good.
I mean, he definitely paid me, you know, which just made me lose my mind even more.
Sure.
You know?
No, I get
as a kid, I mean, it was nuts, man. Cause we would play the Zenith over there in Paris and, you know, and there would be, you know, the L'Oreal people would bring out five models, you know, and put them on the stage on the chairs. And I'm a 19-year-old
good
kid,
Lord.
$3,000 in my pocket with five L'Oreal models sitting 5 feet away. Oh, man, I lost my mind.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was completely out of control. So, yeah, I mean, and that was the beginning of all that. So, I mean, you know, we were playing these big shows. We were going nuts. And it exposed me to that European market. So, by the time I left his band and joined the Buddy Miles Express and did all that stuff, and, you know, I'd already been there as kind of a, you know, playing for him and kind of known as his guitar player. So it opened the door for me, you know, and it opened an audience for me. And there was a fan base there so that when I started putting out those records and the first one that Buddy and I produced, I mean, that's really where I went and toured. You know, was there because I'd already been, you know, playing with Lucky and Buddy there. So I had been going there with more well-known established artists. And it was really funny because when I was over there touring on my own, and I basically virtually, in 2001, I basically moved there in Holland and was there in the Netherlands and was based in Europe and playing with a European band and touring all over the all over Europe and everything. And James Brown came to Belgium, and James Brown tried to hire me in Belgium, and he knew me from all the people that I'd previously backed. And you know, and I was one of the only people that ever turned James Brown down.
How come?
I said, because I'd already been doing all that. That's what I was saying about the daunting thing, being behind all those guys. And I loved James Brown's music so much that I didn't want to end up working for him and end up like, you know, because those guys were all just so jacked up. And then I was, you know, ended up jacked up with all of them. You know, I didn't want to end up hating James Browner's music.
Yeah.
You know, but I'd already kind of, I had the wherewithal to go, man, thank you, but no thank you. And, you know, I was talking to Rocco Prestia from Tower of Power, you know, great bass player one time, telling him that story. And he was like, wow, man, I can't believe you just didn't at least go out and do, you know, 2 weeks. And it was just like, I just couldn't, man, coming from that school, it was just, you know, I'd already kind of done my time, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And it was so hard. It was so flattering to kind of be like, wow, here's Mr. Brown offering me a job. And it was really cool because I had a lifetime laminate that I could go anywhere James, I had full access to anywhere James Brown was until, you know, the day he passed away, I thought, man, wow, I thought about that. I should have at least done one, but you know, but then, like I said, I still had the memories of how much I respected Mr. Brown, and I never got any bad, you know, any kind of bad situations with him to where I just, you know, would end up resenting him. So I, in the long run, I think I made the right choice, but yeah, I mean, going back to your original question, I mean, even though I was over there doing my own thing, here came James Brown in the middle of all of it trying to hire me to go back to do that, you know, to go back to that place. And I said no, and I'm going to keep doing my thing and, you know, continue to try to, and that was 2001. So, you know, we've been beating up the road ever since, you know, trying to make it happen, you know, so. But yeah, it was quite a gamble and quite a challenge and a chance I took.
It was, but in hearing it, it sounds like it was almost because you'd been there so long. That was probably more comfortable and natural to you to stay there, and you had built up a fan base. To come to the U.S. at that point, business wise, would have probably been more of a risk. Now that I hear the whole story,
right?
Yeah,
right.
That makes a lot of sense. So then you did the tours on your own. Then you went back to Europe, opening up in larger scale for guys like Billy Gibbons, Whitesnake, Rod Stewart. Now, how is that experience different from touring on your own in what I'm going to assume were maybe a little smaller venues?
Yeah, I mean, it was. It you know, it just gradually began to get bigger and bigger. And, I'd kind of taken some time and recorded some studio records and put out some albums that really kind of gained a little traction over there, but there was no touring because there was no budget behind those albums. There was really there was just really grassroots and underground kind of a thing. And there wasn't really any tour place or any kind of things to coincide with those releases. So, but I was still continuing to work and create these releases. So, by the time I got over there, I had released probably 3 or 4 records kind of back to back. So there was a body of work that had kind of been gaining a little traction over there in the underground guitar kind of scene. And so when I arrived over there, you know, when I began working with MIG, which was the former Manfred Schütz and the former SPV label that did a lot of heritage metal stuff, you know, with Judas Priest and Motorhead and Dio and that. They had formed another label that, you know, focused on more jazz fusion and blues and rock. So it kind of catapulted me to this whole different scale, like you said, from earlier where I'd been, you know, I had done some great opening slots for Steve Vai and Jeff Beck and a few other people. But now it was like a total grand scale, like stadiums with Whitesnake and Def Leppard, you know, and it was really cool. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was, you know, it was it just seems like it went so quick, you know, because it was like, I mean, you know, you wouldn't think that, but, you know, those stadium shows with Whitesnake and Def Leppard, you know, and I didn't realize the scale that Whitesnake, I mean, I remembered Whitesnake from the 80s as a kid and, you know, always deep admiration for, but, you know, that the scale that they were on in Europe was on a whole other level and So, I mean, that, you know, going from playing stadiums with Whitesnake and Def Leppard to playing, you know, arenas with Joe Cocker and Rod Stewart were, you know, it was pretty monumental. And it definitely kind of made me realize that, that what I was doing at that time, you know, which definitely, you know, guitar slinging, you know, and doing what I do is, something that it takes a lot to translate to a big crowd. You know, and I really began, and this is a conversation I've had quite a bit with Steve Lukather. You know, we've talked about that a lot where that's why a lot of guys still go back to LA and play the baked potato. Because it's cool to see that up close in a club. Sometimes on a big stage, it can be a little bit difficult to catch a bunch of the real fiery stuff. I started to dawn on me when I was, you know, playing those shows. I was like, wow, okay. But, you know, it made me start writing different and developing songs differently, you know, for a bigger stage.
I give you a lot of credit because that is probably not an easy thing to, that's not something you want to realize in a sense, you know, it's like saying, well, what I'm doing today, I cannot make what Whitesnake's doing, and how can I now? I mean, that's like, you know, going to the, you know, that's like something you avoid going to the doctor. You don't want to hear the, it's not bad news, but it's like a pretty stark realization that, shit, I really have to do things differently. And I think that's a tough thing to accept and say, okay, how can I fix it, instead of saying, you know, well, let me pretend it doesn't exist.
Right.
You know,
right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely it is. And it just, you know, and I found myself performing. I mean, the proof was in the pudding. I mean, I found myself performing better. We would go do a stadium gig one day, and then the next day we would be in a club with 500 people, and, you know, and it would just be so much different when the people were right on top of me. You know, when they're right on the edge of the stage and they can reach out and grab my foot, as opposed to I'm on a giant stadium stage and the people are 50 feet away, you know, to the front row between these huge big barricades. And I'm just kind of basically, I'm just playing into a big dark mass. I can hear them, but I can't see them, you know, and that kind of connection, I think, you know, I definitely feed off the audience. So I definitely think that it was a, there was an interaction thing with the crowds and interaction thing with the people and the intimacy, you know, and, you know, you could see when you would be in a club playing for 300 or 500 people, even 1,000 people at some times, but even just in an intimate room like that, you could see the people midway to the back of the room making guitar faces with you.
Yeah.
You know, when I would be on a stadium stage, it would just sometimes, and then you're an opener like that, you're just kind of playing, you know, to the people, and they're, you know, they're kind of reacting however, but it definitely was the interaction thing, and it's like they're so far away, you know, or just the translation on the big stage of a lot of notes. And, you know, and it really, it took me back to when I was a kid, and I love Ed Van Halen. I loved Van Halen. I loved them, and I saw them. I was at their very first show with Sammy Hagar, as a matter of fact, in Shreveport, Louisiana. The very first show they ever did with Sammy. And then I took the correlation. Okay, I saw them, and I was like, wow. But then when I went and saw AC/DC, I was like, okay, this is a little bit more where it was just three chords, and it was just that kind of groove that was happening in a big room, as opposed to, you know, the giant flurries of notes, as opposed to the groove. So and then that's when it all made sense to me. Why am I getting this more than just kind of going, wait a minute, what's happening? You know, and that's what I felt like when I saw Van Halen in a big concert, the many times I saw Ed and was really 10 feet away from him, as opposed to seeing, you know, AC/DC or Angus Young, where it was more simplistic.
Yes.
And a little bit more back down in a big room. It seemed like simpler, translated better, and that's basically my point. And so that's what I really learned from that, was that, you know, it was simplistic actually translated to bigger and better. So that's those were the things that I really truly learned about going out on a big stage. stage.
That's really cool. And if you think about it, look at, you know, ZZ Top. That's exactly what you're saying. I mean, that's very simple music when it comes down to it, but it's like their ability to relate because of that maybe is why they've been so successful for all these years for the same reason.
Exactly. Well, and it's that's the thing too. I mean, if you look at the early records, Billy, I mean, it was no different than kind of some of that same thing. It's that those heavy riffs and, you know, it was heavy, hard rock riff records, much like my early records or a lot of people's early albums. And you have really heavy riff rock stuff that's real busy as opposed to, you know, the early 80s when it went very simplistic, four on the floor, basically dance music.
Right.
That was just on the one pumping. And that's when you saw ZZ Top transform into a stadium act, you know, so it really, you know what I mean? So that's, I mean, and a lot of their early stuff was not simple. It was very power trio based. It was because it was a power trio, but, it, you know, the heavy riffs and the unison lines and that whole kind of thing, you know, very, very much like, you know, what, you know, the Hendrix Experience or Cream, you know. So that's where, you know, you start to begin to realize that, you know, that simpler is better. And you're absolutely right. And that's one of the main things I've learned from Billy is definitely another thing you can add to that list is the groove, you know, and all about the groove and not groove like, and Billy would tell me that and he would always say groove. And I would think groove. I would start thinking James Brown. I would start thinking like funk music, but it was like, no, just a groove, a pocket. You know, and if you listen to, you know, so much of that music, you know, the Eliminator and Recycler and Afterburner, just that pocket, that solid locked in pocket. And that's also what AC/DC had. You know, so many people say, oh, man, you know, that it's the four on the floor. But and you know, Buddy Miles's favorite rock band was AC/DC.
Really?
Because everything, it was four on the floor.
It was.
And that's how Buddy played. I mean, if you listen to him with Hendrix or anybody else, I mean, he was four on the floor. You know, everything was just solid as a rock. And we would sit and listen to AC/DC and watch AC/DC concert videos. He loved them because everything was four on the floor. And that's that groove, you know, that. And when Gibbons would tell me about that, I would be like, groove? I would think, well, that's not really that fine. And I'm thinking like, you know, Tower of Power or like horn bands and like funk bands. And I'm like, groove? It didn't make sense to me. But until I truly then got it and went, oh, like a locked in a pocket, a hypnotic pocket groove.
It's, you know, interesting. I interviewed two of Jeff Beck's guitarists. I had Carmen Vandenberg, who was on the last album, and Jennifer Batten. And one of them said, both great interviews, really cool. But
very cool.
One of them said, I think it might have been Carmen, she said Jeff told her something one time and it was caught her off guard, very similar to what you're saying. He said to her, look, all you need is a really good drummer. We got a really good drummer, everything else falls into place. And we were talking about the same thing, groove, you know?
Yeah.
And just really interesting to hear that. Everybody at that level sort of has the same religion, so to speak, about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk about your new album, or the last one, called Live in New York City. Where was it recorded in New York?
At B.B. King's Blues Club in Times Square.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly where that is, man, right on 42nd Street.
Very
cool. Was that over one show or more than one show?
It was just one show. It was Johnny Winter's 70th birthday party.
Oh, that's so cool.
So, and when I was asked to play Johnny's party, it was, I was overwhelmed. I was like, wow, because I already knew, I'd already planned on being there and I had been invited, you know, but I didn't know that I was going to perform. And I'd been touring with Johnny as his opening act during that time. And we had been touring Europe and we had done some East Coast dates and we were currently doing East Coast dates. And while we were on tour, the party was coming up and I was already on tour with him. So I'd already planned on being there. I'd been invited. And I thought, wow, this is going to be such a great party. And I saw the guest list of, you know, all the people that were big heroes of mine, you know, like Leslie West and Papa Chubby and and, you know, just Joe Louis Walker and on and on and on and on, you know, guys I knew and guys that were heroes of mine. So I thought, wow, this is going to be a pretty bitching party. And it was a big milestone for Johnny.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was 70 years in New York City. I mean, which, you know, had been his home away from home since he left Texas. I mean, you know, he left Texas in 1969 and he never, you know, and he went to New York and shit. He was there for, I don't even know how many years, man. So, you know, it really was a big deal then to be asked to perform. So I thought, man, I'm just going to be great just to be there. But then they were like, no, you're going to be the show opener. You're going to open this show too. This is going to be just like everything we're doing on tour. So yeah. I was like, oh my God. So, you know,
oh man, talk about a little pressure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and that's what we did. And that's where I did kind of start freaking out. I was like, wow, well, this is going to be a big deal. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of people there and a lot of legendary people. And it was just like, you know, Paul Nelson and everybody else were just like, hey man, just go out and do what you've been doing on the road, man. Go out and do what we've been doing. I mean, and so that's what the set is. The set is exactly how we would play on the road. And, you know, and the set is a little bit more rock, and it was a little bit more rock material because, you know, we kind of looked at it as, you know, a lot of people would come up after the shows and they would talk to me, and they were talking to us out on tour, and they would go, man, we want to hear Johnny play, you know, more of his rock material from the mid-70s, you know, the early 70s, you know. And Johnny was all about just playing blues. And right. He was always that way. Even in the 70s when he was doing the rock stuff, he wanted to be straight blues band all the time. So we kind of designed a set that would kind of try to appease that and bring the Texas rock thing out, you know, so that would kind of fulfill some of that for the fans that would want to hear kind of Johnny do that. So we were bringing some kind of Texas rock flavor to the shows. So, but that's all we did. It was no different than what we had been doing on tour, except when I walked out, boom, right there, 2 feet in front of me, sitting on the front row, is Leslie West. You know, I was like, oh my God.
Man, there's
all these other people that I'm looking at in the crowd going, oh man, now I've got to play my ass off, you know?
Well, that being said, you did. It's a great friggin' record, yeah. Man. It was great. It's funny, I just got referred to Leslie, and I'm hoping to get him on here because he's one of my boyhood heroes. And I mean, he's.
Oh my God, me too.
Just phenomenal player. Some questions about the record. Like I said in the beginning, your voice is really great. And were you always a singer as well as a guitar player? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I began singing as I began playing with R&B acts. That's really kind of where I learned to sing, was really, you know, Southern black gospel music, you know, Mississippi Mass Choir. Those are the people that Bobby Blue Bland and Johnny Taylor and those people like Buddy Ace and those guys that I used to back sat me down on those buses and were like, you need to listen to, because you had to sing in those bands. You know, you had to be a background vocalist. I mean, everybody sang, they had full on, you know, choir practice. And it was like, you know, we would be singing, black Southern gospel hymns. So that's where I began singing. I mean, that's how it started. And it was like, you're going to sit down and listen to this music, and this is how you're going to learn how to sing. And basically it was explained to me, like, if you can play all that on a lead guitar, if you can play guitar like that, then you can just, it's no different than translating it to your voice. So, that's where I really began to learn, you know, singing was there. And, so yeah, it's, I was very fortunate to have been around and played with some of the best R&B and blues and soul singers, and was able to learn, you know, directly from them. And, you know, so yeah, that's basically where my vocal background came from.
And your sound is also very distinct, as I'm sure you know. And I was curious, you know, your tone, how long did it sort of take you to find your voice there, and what do you attribute that to? I mean,
a lot of Jack Daniels and a lot of Marlboro Red.
I hear that.
You know, I mean, a lot of hard times on the road, man. But yeah, I mean, you know, and just, you know, it just takes time, man. You know, it's like, it is so much of the adage of, like, you know, BB King, and I work with a lot of kids and stuff, and a lot of real gifted kids, but You know, it's like, you know, B.B. King always said, he goes, man, you know, do you have to play the blues or sing the, do you have to have the blues to play the blues or sing the blues? No, but it sure helps.
Sure helps, I think.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like life experience and time and just, you know, blues is a music of survival. You know, it's a survivor's music. So it does take time and kind of road worn kind of stuff to develop that. And I truly believe that's where the sound really came from. Matter of fact, I know it is. Mm. And that's, you know, so it just took time and a lot of miles, you know.
I hear you. Let's talk about some of the songs. The first song is Come Back Home. And I hear like a lot of, Freddie King influences in your soloing there. And I assume you being from Texas, he was a big influence on your playing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, there's no way around it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way around being a Texas blues guitar player and not having to go through that channel. There's just, and especially being in Dallas.
Yeah.
I mean that, you know, he's the pinnacle.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and so much of the world views Dallas and Austin, but really Dallas is Stevie Ray Vaughan. You know, they always think, but us guys in Dallas, it was really, and even Stevie Ray himself, it was all Freddie King.
Hmm.
You know, and I think when you're from there and you're a guitar player there, it definitely is. That's, you know, and so many of the stories, you know, and I know his daughter, I know his family and many of his band members and all of his people there. But yeah, there's no way around being a Texas blues guitar player from my region, yeah, from East Texas, because Freddie was actually from a little town called Gilmer, which is nearby Longview, which is East Texas, which is about 2 hours east of Dallas. So that whole region, and I play there regularly, and I'm there. I mean, so Freddie was a big regional guy for us. So he was right there from where we're from. And, you know, the influence is monumental, you know? So yeah, absolutely. It's, he's just so embedded into us, you know, he's kind of the top of the pyramid for my region of blues guitar players. So yeah, there's no way around getting out of the Freddie King influence for sure.
He was my, of the three Kings, he was always my favorite. I mean, I obviously love Albert and PB, but Freddie did something.
Yeah.
I think I think he just played the blues. For me, it hit me in my soul better than anybody else personally.
Yeah.
Hard Time, that song. My question is, how'd you get those crunchy chord tones? I was curious what guitar you were playing on and what you were playing through. And was it any pedals or was that all overdrive from the amp?
Yeah, I was playing through a Marshall and I had a single cut. I think I was playing a PRS 245. I think it was when I was working with Paul. I worked with Paul for a few years there. And just an old Marshall amp. I think I was using if I remember correctly, I was using a Mojo amp pedal. There's a pedal company down here in Southeast Texas, near from where Johnny Winter's from, near Beaumont, called Mojo Hand. And they had developed a pedal called the Rook, and it was an overdrive. And it was a really cool overdrive pedal, and they had a first run of them. They still have some now that are really cool. But it was one of those first run of the Mojo Hand Rook overdrive pedals. And a lot of guys were using them right when they came out. And it's a really cool pedal. You can still get them from Mojo Hand. And lo and behold, they had a great Marshall amp there. And because I think Leslie was supposed to get up and play, and he never did. I think he left.
That's weird.
After my set. Yeah, and Leslie was supposed to play, and he never did. So there was this phenomenal Marshall amp that I used for the recording. And the thing was, is like, oh, yeah, we got this Marshall because Leslie West is going to be there. So I was like, well, lucky for me, I get to play this amp. And Leslie never played. So
is it like an old Plexi or something?
No, it was a DSL 100.
Hmm.
It was a JCM 2000, which is, you know, I was turned onto those amps by Jeff Beck many years ago. So, it's a workhorse amp. It's an amp that I'm very familiar familiar with, but you know, it's just like any Marshall amp. This one just happened to be really, really, really good.
Yeah, it sounded fantastic, man.
It did, and it was a really special one. It was a really, really good amp, and you know, I think we ended up buying it that night. I mean, it sounded so good. It was like we have to get this amp, and
that's cool.
I think Paul Nelson bought it right there on the spot.
That's really cool. He's a brilliant guy, man. I had a really long conversation. I mean, it's amazing how smart that guy is. I mean, musically, yeah. You know, he's just got the musical education, and he's just a bright person, how he looks at things.
Yeah. Berkeley is, I think Paul was a Berkeley guy, you know, so, but yeah. We had that, this great Marshall amp. And so, yeah, it was, I was really pleased with the tone, and I really didn't realize how good it was. Just a throw and go kind of thing until I heard the recording back, and I was like, wow, man, because I didn't even know this was recorded. So, you know, it was really cool to kind of hear back. But yeah, the riff of Hard Time came about. I think I was hanging out with Warren Haynes on the bus one night, and we had after a government meal show, and we had the guitars out, and or maybe it was backstage, I can't even remember, but it just kind of came up from just jamming around and sitting that double picked, E and A string kind of thing, kind of came something that we kind of threw out there. And so I kind of just took it and developed it. It just came out of a jam sitting around backstage with Warren. And then the next thing you know, I developed it into this song, you know, so.
And your solo on that song, holy shit, sound like you ran out of cigarettes or something like that. You're like on fire on that, dude.
Oh, wow. Like I said, I mean, when you got the guys that I had 2 feet away from you staring at you like, okay, man, what are you going to do next? You know, it was like, fuck, man, I better bring it.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, you better, you know. And then it was Johnny, you know. It was like, I knew I had this was a big honor to play for Johnny's party. So it was like, man, you better get out there and fucking do it justice, man. Because it was like, you know what I mean? It was a big deal. So, that was kind of driving me to play a little bit more over the top than usual, you know.
Well, speaking of which, the last song, I think it's the last song, Low Down Ways, that's a really cool, very long, slow blues jam, but it's like 7 minutes long.
Right.
And your playing on that is incredibly aggressive. And I had a question here. I said, did you have something on your mind that you were pissed off at? Was like, because you just like attacked the shit. I mean, it was like, wow, you know?
Yeah, I mean, man, that was a real rough period for me. Yeah, man, that was always Low Down Ways, especially when it was written and we recorded it on Handmade Music. But when we would play it live, especially during that time, man, it was like, I was in a marriage that was going bad. You know, I was on the road. I was like struggling with drugs and alcohol and just being on the road. And then a marriage that was like falling. I mean, the blues, man.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like the real deal shit. You know, it was the real deal blues that I was like surviving through. I mean, it was not even like living through. It was like I was like surviving through it. Like every day it was like, you know. Just a rough thing. So, yeah. So, I mean, that was coming out on top of already being, you know, this is Johnny Winter's party. I got all these legendary guitar players, you know, staring at me and that. But it was also, yeah, it was coming from that place, man. I'm glad you picked up on that, because absolutely that's what it was, man. And so that was really a portion of it was almost like a therapy for me.
It sounded like it, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, because it was just where I just left it all out there. You know, it was because I was going through so much shit that it was a point of time to where I could just really dump it all out during that song. And that's what I did, you know. And that's what I love about being a blues guitar player. That's one of the things that I very first ever saw Stevie Ray Vaughan do when I was a kid. I was like, holy shit, I felt that. And you could tell that's the same thing. It was like, wow, there's an outlet that I can release all this bullshit I'm feeling, you know, and that's less destructive than anything else. And so that's where I, you know, that's what that is. And that's why you can, and I'm glad you can hear that, because that's absolutely what was going on.
You'd have to be deaf not to hear that. I actually had some guitar questions on that song. That song, you do a really good job at the end of like building up to a crescendo, but it's a very long, very powerful crescendo. Okay.
Right.
And there's a lot of guitar players. Hey, hang on one second. I have a 15-year-old dog, and she's trying to bust through my door. Hang on.
Oh,
she's,
look out.
Yeah, well, she's got anxiety. She's freaking out. Hang on.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Lance?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, sorry about that, man. So I was wondering, when you're working up to a huge, powerful ending like that, is that like something you just decide to do, or is that planned? And like, how much preparation do you give yourself to before your closing to do that? You know, I mean, is there a process, or was that just all spontaneous, I guess is the question.
A lot of it's all spontaneous. A lot of it, I don't sit down and go, okay, from this point A to point B, and in 3.4 minutes, I'm going to go here, there, and then back here, and then back down there, and then here. I mean, it just, like I said, when I have all this pent up stuff, it's like, that's how it just naturally comes out. I don't sit there and go, man, let me think this through, or I know I have a series of licks that I've developed over time, you know, from various sources that I've kind of tried to forged to become mine, that I've taken from various influences that I've kind of developed, and licks that I've kind of come to me from just sitting around playing. But there is definitely no formula for me to sit down and go, okay, I'm going to go from here to here. I start out that blues, and then I just start focusing on the blues that I'm going through, and then just that's how it just all starts coming out.
And another question about that, when you are, this is, I guess, a general question in closing guitar solo buildups in general.
Yeah.
And it may even make sense, but is it more important to climb the neck, you know, up the neck?
Oh, yeah.
Or increase speed, increase volume? Or is there any, like, advice? Like, is there one thing more important than the other?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Now, technically, yeah. No, absolutely. So That is the one part about it, is like that, what I just talked about. You have to have the emotive sense behind it. You have to have the emotion, and that's what authenticates it. Okay. That, for me, that's what makes it authentic, and that makes it to why you could hear it, listen to it, and go, wow, this dude's going through some shit. You know what I mean? But the other side of it is, yes, as I'm building it and I'm getting up to those high notes, yeah, I mean, it is a matter of climbing. It's a matter of ascending and descending, you know, and there's a matter of, once I've ascended so far, then there needs to be, you know, it's just peaks and valleys and ebbing and flowing. So definitely, I mean, just like emotions do, just like an argument does, just like a conversation does, it's the same kind of thing. You know, it's almost
That's
like,
a really good point. Yeah.
You know, it's definitely being in that same kind of interaction. I'm interacting with my guitar, and I'm kind of getting it all out there, you know. So it's basically the same kind of thing, and the ascending and the descending, and the going up really high, and then the going down really low. And then the dynamics, you know, and I learned so much of the dynamic playing from from some, all the great blues guys that I played with or I've ever seen, or, you know, some of the greatest stuff I've ever saw Buddy Guy play was super.
Oh my God. Yeah. He does that. He sucks you right in with that, man.
Right.
I actually saw Johnny open up for Buddy at the Beacon Theater in New York at like the early 80s. That was a pretty crazy show, but yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He's great, Buddy Guy, like that, with his whispering stuff.
Yeah, so that's, you know, it was just always, I think that's kind of one of the main kind of traditional technical things of the blues, but, you know, that's one of the things. And I've always thought that even getting quieter and building up that speed, I don't just go, okay, I'm going to play real, real fast. I never set out, and Johnny Winter and I had this conversation so many times where it's not a matter of I'm trying to be the fastest or I'm trying to play super fast. That's just how much shit I got to get off my chest. That's just how much stuff, man, that I need to get out of me. And Johnny, me and Johnny got it, and Johnny was so blown away because I brought that up to Johnny, and he was like, oh, my God, that's one thing that brought us so close together because he had been thinking it all these years, and I said it. So it was like, yeah, man, there's not a point of, like, I'm going to go out here and I'm going to be the fastest guy, you know. I mean, God, I knew Sean Lane, man. I mean, Sean was a good friend of mine. And, you know, Eric Gales took me here.
Who's Sean Lane?
Sean was a guitar. If you don't know who Sean Lane is, go Google Sean Lane, the Memphis Monster. This guy was freaking incredible. Eric Gales learned so much from Sean. And Eric actually took me over there and introduced me to Sean right before he passed away. Sadly, he had some sort of arthritic type of autoimmune disorder, and then he passed away from it. And but I met him, you know, shortly before he passed away, and he was incredibly fast. And go Google him, go YouTube him, check out some of
Sean's videos. Sean Lane.
Yeah, Shawn. Sean, he was from Memphis, and Gales was good friends with me. So I was like, man, after seeing Sean, and I did some lessons with Sean. I sat down with Sean, and I was like, you got to be kidding me, man. Like, he was showing me these runs, and it was just like, I mean, it was like Eric Johnson times 100. I mean, I'm not even kidding. Like, you wouldn't even see his hands. It would just be a blur, and you'd be like, what the fuck was that?
Wow.
So, you know, so the point is that, you know, being around those guys like that, it's like, man, it's just a point of, you know, expressing the blues and just getting it all out right then and there. You know, that's kind of more what it is than trying to be super fast and go, okay, I'm going to do these arpeggiated, you know, minor pentatonic sixths and eighths and sweep picking and all this shit. It's like, no, man, it's like, that's how much stuff I'm trying to get out at one time, you know,
yeah.
It's like, you know, there's so much emotion behind those notes and so much stuff coming out all at once. It's like, you know, it almost creates a traffic jam.
It was. You know? And let me be clear to everybody listening. There's in no way was I saying that, you know, you were going fast for, I mean, this is a legit playing. I mean, you were going fast for a reason, you know, it made sense.
Yeah, you're right.
Everybody, check out, by the way, so the song I'm talking about is called Low Down Ways. It's the last song on Live in New York City by Lance Lopez. It's his last album. That last song, if you like music, it's one of the greatest endings of a live blues solo I hear. And if you're a guitar player, it's like a lesson in how to build a closing crescendo. It's awesome. On Facebook, Lance, you've mentioned a few times about getting sober and about Music Cares. I've interviewed actually a number of people who've got sober through Music Cares help. And as we talked about earlier, I had a lot of friends who've gotten sober and a few of the people close to me that struggle with addiction. And
right.
I just want to ask you a few questions if you're comfortable talking about your journey along these lines.
Absolutely, man.
Okay, cool. So when did you start using? Was it back in Europe when you were hanging with those guys?
I mean, just as a kid, you know, man, being around, you know, bands and, you know, stoner kids in high school, you know, and junior high, that's kind of where it all began for me. Older brothers and sisters. I grew up, you know, going to concerts, man, in the 80s as a little kid.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were passing around stuff at shows and, you know, then it was always like, let's get the little kid stoned and see what it'll do, you know, kind of thing. And then drinking was always around, you know, with the adults and the family and, you know, my family always drank. And so there was always sneaking beers and sneaking drinks. And, you know, like I said, then being around the rock music scene early on, there was, you know, there was drugs. And then, as I got older, the hard drugs really got bad because, like I said, I was around a lot of the old blues guys who were really, really, you know, in bad shape by the time I got around them. And it was like, if you want to be able to hang, you know, you could do this, which is really what, man, it really, and God bless them, man. I mean, you know, of course they were addicts and they were sick too. I have to look back at that now, but it was like, I work with kids, man. You know, I work with kids. I'm a guitar instructor as well. I mentor children, and never in a million years would I ever go to a child and go, man, if you want to be badass, you got to do something. And that's where, you know, I look back at just how damaged these guys were, you know, and just how sick they were, man. You know, it's really, so I can't really like be resentful and go, oh man, these guys, you know, they got me all fucked up. It, no, these guys were,
they were just a messenger, know? Man. And unfortunately, you know, that,
yeah,
if it wasn't them, it would have been somebody else, the next guy.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So it was like, you know, but I think back on that now, just how damaged it, you know, I was early on. And so, yeah, it just, then it just became a matter of, you know, went from partying just to kind of to cope. And, you know, just it spiraled so out of control. And then there, you know, the real bad elusive part of my using and drinking, and I think a lot of musicians deal with this, was there is that magical moment you get where, like, if I do this right combination of, you know, drugs and alcohol, you know, if I take this amount of heroin with this amount of speed with this other pill and smoke some of this and drink some of that, and you, all of a sudden you have like this unbelievable kind of performance thing that happens, and then it, like, that's the deception of it. And then you're like, you do have a moment where it takes you somewhere else, but then you know, it definitely just fails you, you know, and leaves you really bad, you know, in bad shape. So I think that's for a musician. Like, if I take something or snort something, it makes me play faster, or makes me hear clearer, or makes me focus better, or, you know, I take some kind of like acid or something that really expands my consciousness and I can see the notes or something. Then it's like, you know, for me, it's like I constantly tried to recapture that and chase that. I never got it again. And it just, and then, but by the time I looked up, it was like, holy shit, what's happened to my life, you know? And that was a hard thing to come out of, you know, it was a hard thing to beat. And thank God for Music Cares, man, for being there for me. And, you know, I plan on trying to, they saved my life. I mean, you know, Music Cares saved my life. You know, I continue to help other addicts that are struggling with Music Cares, that are musicians, through Music Cares, you know, and help try to give back as much as I can. Because, I mean, I owe them my life. I mean, seriously, I do. And so it's a great journey. And then, you know, I've got so many blessings today. I look around at my life and I just go, wow, man, I can't. You know, because there was a time where I thought I would be sitting in a dark room going, man, I am not going to make it another 5 minutes. I'm not going to live till the end of the night, you know. And then just sit around and look at my life now and go, wow. You know, they're just, when I wake up in the morning, a lot of times I just look around and go, wow. You know, to fast forward from that dark place I was at to today, it's just a giant wow moment all the time. So, you know, I just do a series of things every day, and I'm heavily involved in recovery and helping others. And, you know, it's a daily thing for me now. So, you know, when I go into a new town, it's, you know, I find the recovery stuff, you know, I damn sure used to go try to find the drugs and the alcohol.
Yeah, right. No, funny how that, no reason now why you can't find a meeting. Absolutely,
exactly,
man.
Exactly.
You know,
now that's what I do.
It's interesting. A buddy of mine who went through that, he said that, one of the things they taught him in the program was that, one of the many sayings that he vibed with him was, you know, you start taking whatever your drug of choice is to solve the your problems as a solution to your problems, and then the solution becomes your new problem.
Right.
You know, so exactly. It made me think of that when you went through it. What was like bottom for you, if you're comfortable talking about that, prompted you that you said, fuck it, I'm done?
Man, I was out with Johnny Winter. And, you know, as a matter of fact, after that, after we recorded live at NYC, I was on a big run. We were in New York City. I was partying real hard. And, I went to a recession. Paul said, hey man, we've got to go to a recording session and I need your help mixing this track with, Billy Gibbons and Johnny. And let me back up even further, because about a month before that, I was in LA and I was blowing and going real hard down in West Hollywood. And, I was at the Rainbow, you know, all the time. That was my hang down and I still go there and have, it's the best Italian food, I think, in LA, but I would kind of stay out in the bar portion. And I was just, you know, just drinking, being crazy, and just going full on, full throttle, nonstop, just drugs, alcohol, Hollywood craziness. And I got in off of like a 5-day bender, and I actually got a call from Music Cares. And they had actually, I mean, you know, the stories of my the tales of my, you know, binging and getting crazy was kind of spreading throughout, and I actually got the call to be offered help.
So they called you?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was like offered me help, and a friend of mine who's a very well-known actor actually called me on their behalf and said, and I just, you know, and I'm not going to say it's due to anonymity.
No, of course. You don't
have to say that. But a friend of mine who's a very well-known actor from out there called me and said, hey, man, you know, and he set up another intervention that also had some very well-known legendary people involved in it. And I didn't show. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to show up. And they actually staged an intervention.
Holy shit, and you didn't show up.
And I never went. I was like, yeah, I'll be there, man. And I, you know, and that's like, it's like, so if you're ever going to try to do an intervention on anybody, don't call them and tell them you're going to do it.
You knew it was an intervention.
Oh, yeah, they gave me a heads up.
Man, that's kind of like common sense, not for nothing. I mean, that. You tell an addict you're going to go to inviting an addict to an intervention. I don't know, to be honest with you, that's not a smart thing to do. It's like inviting a murderer to an.
Some of my heroes were part of the intervention, so that just shows you how.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
Exactly. Shows you how strong the shit really is.
Yeah,
man.
Of course.
You know, and so about a month later, we were in New York, and I was on a session with Paul, and we were mixing this track at Carriage Hall Studios of Johnny Winter and Billy Gibbons on that Where Can You Be song, and I'd done a bunch of drugs, and you know, I didn't even know, Paul sprung it on me the last minute, and I was in the middle of like getting high, and I was like, oh man. And
you're interrupting my partying. What the fuck?
and then I ended up and I was nodded out at the console, and everybody was just kind of standing around me, and I kind of came to, and everybody was looking at me like, man,
wow,
you know, just looking at me as I was like supposed to be mixing, and my face was like embedded into the console.
Wow.
You know, and so I went out and called Music Cares back and said, man, they go, how quick can you get to the airport? We'll get you a plane, and we'll get you to treatment. And I went, oh, well, but I'm still on tour. I'm ready, but I'm countered. You know? And then I was like, I don't know. And then another month went by. I finished the tour with Johnny, and I went back to L.A. and did another big round of partying. And by that time, I got back. And when I got back from that one, I called them back. And they go, man, you ready now? And it, 3 months later, I finally said, I'm, and you know, there was no point of, for me, there was not a point of, like, oh man, you know, I'm, you know, because so many times I tried to do it for everybody else, you know, whether I got in trouble or whether mom or girlfriend or mom and dad or whoever else or wife or girlfriend or getting in trouble and all that stuff. It was a matter of, I mean, I was sitting in front of a giant pile of drugs with a brand new bottle, and I just stood up from it and just walked away from it. You know, it was just that moment where it was time to be done, you know, and I had to get there, and I was lucky to have survived it. And I was lucky that Music Cares was there waiting for me to just to go, come on, man, we're waiting on you to get help, you know. So they literally saved my life and provided an opportunity for me to get the help that I needed and to get, if anybody out there is listening and you know a musician that needs drug treatment, contact Music Cares and they can definitely help you.
I really thank you for sharing that, man. That's a good story, and I hope somebody listening to that, that was really cool. So how long have you been sober now?
It's been about 3.5 years.
Congratulations, man. I'm happy, yeah, man, for you. That's really good. That's a tough thing to do. And, yeah, you know, you were a professional at partying as much as you're professional at guitar. When you're partying at that level, to put the brakes on it is not easy, man. And so I really do give you credit. It's a tough thing.
And I'm really grateful because a lot of my friends are all following behind me one by one, you know, so I'm really, you know, and I hope that does. And that's my main purpose really today, not only being a guitar player, but to help others that are struggling, man. So hopefully there is somebody listening that, you know, that, you know, that's one thing I will talk to you about. So if you need to, if you're struggling, man, feel free to reach out to me and I'll try to help you any way I can.
It's funny. I talked to, I'm not going to say who, but I was interviewing somebody one time and they said, "Hey man, you should go to some NA meetings in LA. You'd get a ton of guys on your show." prospecting technique. So it was joking, of course, but it was pretty funny.
Right.
If you could go back in time and give advice to your younger self, outside of, you know, don't use drugs probably, what advice would you have given about the business itself and about, you know, moves that you need to make or not make?
I would always say, never let anybody tell you that I got you here. You know, your talent gets you where you go. And that's one of the things, to never let anybody manipulate you and tell you that I'm the reason that you're doing such and such and so and so. You get yourself those places by your hard work and your talent and your God-given talent. And God really puts you at the right place at the right time. I'm not trying to get all preachy style, but that's the thing to remember, is that, you know, that's who puts you in that position, and that's, you know, and your talent and hard work gets you where you go. So don't ever let anybody tell you you're only here because of me, because you're where you are because of you and because you of your hard work with your music and your talent.
Did people run that line of BS by you when you were a kid?
Oh, there's been a lot of people, you know, that I've had, you would be nothing without me, or you wouldn't be here without me. And that's never the case.
No.
And I've been in some bad situations, believing that.
Yeah. You're so young and you had no coping skills at all to handle any,
right.
What you did at the ages you did it. It's like almost nobody could have, I mean, at 17, 18, even 20, you had no coping skills at that age. I mean, to handle all that shit, and you don't have anybody around you to sit and, you know, give you the fatherly advice that you needed. So it's just like, it's a tough thing, man.
It was tough. Yeah.
Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes. Okay. What's your go-to guitar, right? And first of all, let me tell everybody that, Lance is sitting in a room. It's like, you know, Manny's Music or, you know, Carter Vintage. It's like a wall to wall massive fucking amps and heads and Marshalls, Dr. Z, Bogner. It's like, you know, it's like Christmas for any guitar player.
We got all this.
Yeah. Here. He's got his Thunderbird. Yeah. There he's go. That's his man cave. Very cool, man. What's your go-to guitar right now, and like, what other two guitars would you say would round out your top three?
Well, man, I mean, you know, right here we got this is the Barton Creek Burst. This is my 59, my R9 Les Paul. That's my main guitar I've been playing lately. And a great story about that guitar is, the Barton Creek Burst came. It's an R9, but it's a very, very, very special guitar. I mean, it's not just, you know, one of your run of the mill R9s that you get off the rack there.
You said Barton Creek. What does that mean?
Barton Creek is an area of Austin.
Okay.
So Barton Creek is, there's the Barton Creek Resort. So that's where I acquired the guitar. The guitar was sent from the custom shop in Nashville to the Gibson showroom in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
Down on South Congress. So I had a movie premiere to attend of a film that I'm actually involved in, called Sidemen. It's about three guys, Hubert Sumlin and two other guys who played with Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters.
Awesome.
Anyway, so I'm in the film and I did the soundtrack for the film. So it was the big screen debut at the South by South Film Festival in South by Southwest was going on. So let's rewind, go back before that. I had a tour booked of the West Coast, and I had two nights at the Baked Potato, one of which had already sold out. And in LA, and a couple of other shows up and down the West Coast. And Gibson called me and said, they said, man, we need you to play this Gibson Custom Shop party at the showroom in Austin at South by Southwest for this giant party. And there's going to be a lot of very notable people, and you know, you really need to do this for the custom shop. And I go, man, I'm booked. You know, I'm booked in California. And oh man, is there any way? And I think they tried to get Leroy Parnell, or they had Leroy Parnell, and they had a couple of other guys, and guys just kept falling off. And they go, oh man, we really need you to do this. So I said, man, let me see what I can do. So I called and rescheduled the other dates, and Justin at the Baked Potato was kind of pissed off because he'd already sold out one night, you know. But I went, man, it's for Gibson. I mean, I really need to do this. I have an endorsement deal with them. And so
is that's a hard thing to, you're kind of like damned if you do, damned if you don't on that. Right. You just got to make a judgment call and say, hey, fuck it, whatever happens, because that's a tough, yeah.
I was in a weird position. And, yeah. And you know, my A&R guy, who I love to death over there, Mark Somgeneri, he's one of the best guys I know in the business and in the world. I love Mark to death. And Mark was like, man, you know, if you can. So I did it. You know, I jumped through all these hoops and did all this stuff and really kind of, you know, disappointed some people. The other gigs weren't too bad. I just rescheduled everything. And they were real cool about it once I said, you know, hey, it's for Gibson. It's South by Southwest. I really need to do this. And by the time, and the cool thing about it was by the time I got home after all, you know, my band and the money that I would have spent and the money that I would have made for the one show with Gibson, I was going to make almost as much as I would have made for that whole tour.
Good for
one
you. Show. Good. Awesome.
So that's where I went. You know, it was that deal. Plus I knew I could reschedule it. And then that was, you know, and they offered me that because I was kind of going, man, I got a whole tour I need to do. So then
I think, hang on 1 second. I think, thank you for talking about that, because I think that for some reason, I'm coming from the business world, right? And a lot of people I meet in music, it's almost like taboo to want to make money. And then there's a lot of bitching about how musicians don't make enough money. So I'm like, I don't get, you know, if it's taboo, it either is or it's not. But if it's taboo in your mind, you can't bitch about you're not making a lot of money. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I'm glad you said that. You're like, hey, man, I looked at this deal. I'm getting a shit ton of money to do this. I could reschedule the other ones. I mean, that's like common sense as a business person to me.
Right. Right. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I got kids, man. I have a family.
Well, you're doing this. You're not doing this or running a fucking chat.
I got a family to support.
Well, you're not running a, you know, a 501c3 charitable organization. You're in business to make money. You know, that's totally cool. It's like normal. That's why people go in business. Right. You're in a guitar business. I mean, it's like, you know, sorry, man. I just like, I hear people bitching.
No, yeah, absolutely. And so that's why I had to go, you know, and so I had to go back and forth with him for a while. And so I said, okay, man, let's try to do this. So, man, we get a week out from the gig, and my A&R guy from Gibson calls me, and he's like, Lance, he goes, man, you got a minute? And I was like, and he goes, the show at South has been canceled.
Oh,
and I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me, man. Like, no way. He's like, yeah. And so I go, man. And right, as soon as I was getting ready to launch into it, he goes, you know, as soon as I was getting ready to launch into the whole thing, he says, man, I'm going to pay you anyway. We're going to, Gibson's going to cut you a check. We're going to mail you a check. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. But now I'm like, you know, I've got, you know, then I start thinking about the people that bought all the tickets at the Baked Potato.
Right.
You know, these other shows. And I'm like, oh man. And they're like, we're going to pay you anyway. And so I went, man, okay, well, then it came around, you know, three nights later, whenever it was, and I'm supposed to, now I'm not playing in California. Now I'm not playing at all. I'm sitting at home. And so I write an email to, you know, the guys at the custom shop, and a bunch of those guys aren't there anymore, by the way. And I wrote a big email out, and I basically started the email by going, you know, guys, I'm not pissed off, but I am pissed off. You know, it was one of those where, hey man, I'm not really saying something, but I am, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's like, I'm not pissed, but I'm pissed.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, one of those kind of, so I said, you know, hey man, keep me in mind. You know, I really took a big hit on this deal. And, you know, so I just want you to know that my dedication to Gibson and how hard I work for you guys, and how, you know, that I just canceled the tour to do this, and then you guys did this. So I, you know, man, I just want to show you how my loyalty. And hit send, and within within about 10 minutes, my phone was ringing. And they went, man, you know, Lance, man, we get it. We got it, man. We're in apologizing some more. And he goes, hey, man, in lieu of us cutting you a check for that gig, can we just build you something? Anything you want. What do you want? Do you want us to build you something? What do you want? What is there a guitar you want? Name it, and you got it. We'll give you whatever you want. We'll special guitar. And I go, man, I just want, you know, I want an amazing R, you know, 59 Les Paul. I want an amazing 59. And so they were like, you got it. You have got it, man. Whatever you want. And so Steve Christmas, who's no longer there, Kevin Von Pommel, Steve Christmas, the guys that they're no longer at the custom shop, Rick Gimbar, those guys that were there for running that custom shop for almost 30 years, they're all gone now recently, by the way. They went back to the back. So here's what they've done. Over the years, they've had the ability and the opportunity to go to Jimmy Page's house, / Don Felder, Billy Gibbons. I mean, they have been able to go to everybody's burst. And that's why they've come out with all these collector's choice and these signature series and these cloned bursts. And I think the newest one they have coming out now is Mick Ralph's from Bad Company, you know, where they go and they can clone a burst. They can go out there and they can take the specs and they measure it and they get all the specs off of it and they can clone them down to the dings and the nicks, you know, just like anything else. So they basically have these all the specs to everything, the measurements, the specs, the pickup readout, the whole thing. And so they what they did is Steve Christmas went back and got this burst, and what they've done is it has appointments of several different bursts. The pickups are one thing, the body's another thing, the neck shape, the whole thing. And it's kind of a blend of Pearly Gates, Jimmy Page's number one, and a couple of other different bursts. That's why it's very special. People say, oh, well, it's not a vintage. It's not a $500,000 burst, but man, it's got specs made
up.
Man,
it's an R9. What?
And it's got specs made up from about five different very notable R9s, you know? So it was kind of a mixture of the specs come from different Les Pauls, which makes it I've A-beat it against vintage ones. I've A-beat it against other R9s, and it is truly hands down. It is, we've A-beat it next to vintage R9s, and there was guys that other than it, you know, being newer, couldn't tell the difference at all. And actually nice. Preferred that guitar over a vintage. So, it's a very special one. So, we call it the Barton Creek Burst because when they got it in, my A&R guy called me and he was virtually in tears. I mean, he was like, this guitar, he was speechless. And so I'm going, wow, you see these things every day. And he was like, no, man. I mean, he was like, it was like this holy thing, you know? So when I got to Austin, we went in there and I played it and I was like, oh my gosh, you know, then I realized this guitar is not just a, you know, an R9 that you would go and play in Guitar Center. And so we went to the movie debut. So we stayed at the Barton Creek Ranch. It's a Barton Creek Resort out there. And so my wife was with me and she's like, oh, well, let's go to this, you know, let's stay at this Omni Resort. And so all these amenities and spas and all this bullshit. And I just sat on the couch and played that bird.
when was this?
She got it. You know, she was like, okay, we'll just sit right there. I'm going to go to the spa, you know? And I was like, so that's why I call it the Barton Creek Burst, because I sat there and literally stayed up all night playing that guitar at the Barton Creek Ranch, man, while, you know.
And when was this? How many years ago?
This was 3 years ago, 2 years ago.
Man, so it's interesting how all this good shit is happening after you got sober.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to tell you is it's like if I go back to that dark room And then fast forward to now, it's like you just sit there and just go, wow.
Yeah.
You know, go, man. Because there was, you know, like I said, there was a time where it was like, man, I'm not going to make it another 5 minutes. Like, I don't think I'm going to live to the end of the night.
Right.
And to look around at my life now, yeah, it's a direct result. I mean, everything now is a direct result.
Well, and the thing is, not that you don't have bad moments like that now, but when you have those thoughts, you know what to do with them. You have better coping skills. You have people to call for help, and you have experience at handling that situation sober. You know, because a lot of people, I think, are mistakenly under the belief that when you change, you no longer have whatever problems. You still have them. You just have better ability to deal with them.
Tools to deal with.
Yeah. It's like more arrows in your quiver. Well, that's a great story, man. Thank you. What would be the other two, your other two guitars to round out your top three?
Man, I've got a really cool 65, another custom shop Gibson 65 reissue Firebird 5.
You know what? Not a lot of people play those. When I saw you playing it, I was like, that's pretty interesting because that's not a common guitar, really.
Yeah, well, it came about from Johnny. Johnny was the one that was like, you know, I was hanging out with Johnny, and I was working with PRS at that time, and he was like, well, that's cool, but, you know, you ever played a Firebird? And I played Johnny's and played a couple, you know, the one that's like the sunburst that had the twisted neck, and the neck was like warped in the strings, and he only had it set up for slide.
Yeah, that was his slide guitar. I remember that, yeah.
The slide guitar, which I've got a sunburst now set up for slide as well. But I, you know, it was a thing where, you know, whenever those guys like Johnny or Billy Gibbons or BB King or anybody said, hey man, I think you would sound good doing this. Then I did it. I never went, oh man, you think so? You know, because I got Johnny Winter sitting there going, man, I think you'd sound good on a Firebird and a Marshall amp or something. And I went, okay, cool. That's what we're going to do next. Oh, man, Johnny, I don't know. You know?
Yeah.
When Gibbons was like, I like you on a Les Paul. Then I was like, okay. And I never went, you think?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's those guys, you know, yeah. Billy Gibbons, BB King, Johnny, you don't question those guys. You just do what they tell you to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
They go, thanks, man.
No, 100%. 100%. Yeah, you got a guy lucky enough.
I didn't question them. I didn't. You know, because there's guys, oh, man, I wish you'd play Strat again. I mean, you saw what my guitar collection I have.
Yeah.
I've got guitars all over the room.
Yeah.
And I still do. But it just, for me, I enjoy playing all kinds of guitars. But, you know, for my sound, I was very lucky and fortunate enough to be around those guys that helped me kind of guide me in a direction and go, hey, man, I think you sound good like this. You know, when Billy Gibbons says, hey, man, I think I like you on that Flying V or I like you on that Les Paul. It was like, and Johnny Winter said, man, I think you'd sound real good on a Firebird. Why don't you get a Firebird? It was like, we're going to get a Firebird.
Well, yeah, you're a humbucker. I mean, you're a humbucker guy. That's you're a humbucker player, your tone, everything.
Right.
You're not a single, to me anyway, I don't see you on a single coil.
Right.
It doesn't really match.
Yeah.
Not that you don't play it well, but you know what I'm saying.
Right.
Cool. So you got the 59 R9, the 65 reissue Firebird. What would be the number three?
I've got a really cool guitar right now that I've been really playing. I'm gonna take out next year. It's a new custom shop guitar called the Modern Double Cut Standard.
Okay, the new ones that they have.
And it's really cool, man. I got a sunburst one right here, man, and it's a really cool guitar. I'm really spending a lot of time with it. I'm probably gonna take it on tour with me. And it's really, really cool. I mean, it's you know, for a lot of the traditional guys, it takes them a while to get used to the look and the body shape of it all. But it's really, really cool, man. It's got it's a mahogany body with a maple cap like a Les Paul, but it's got double cuts. So you get girth and wideness of a Les Paul, but then you also get the SG thing.
Get access.
It's got 24 frets on it. So you can get way up there and do a lot of really high end stuff, like we were talking about earlier, the climbing all the way up and the ascending and descending. That's something that that's really cool on this guitar. It's 24 fret. It's got 57 classics.
I love those pickups, classics. Man.
Yeah, 57 classic and plus in the bridge and a 57 classic in the neck. So, and it's got an ABR1 on it.
What is that?
That's really, the bridge.
Oh, okay, okay.
Which is the classic bridge. And then the cool thing about it is it's got two volume knobs. It's got a volume and a tone, one volume knob. So a volume and tone.
Oh, wow. So
the middle position for Gibson, that's a lot different, you know, from the four knobs.
Yeah.
Because I do a lot of middle position stuff, and especially playing blues, you know. And this is really it's just dialed in perfectly where so many guys that I talk to go, oh man, you know, when I go in the middle, I have to really dial it in. And I'm not good at dialing it in on the fly. This is a one volume, one tone. I mean, that's it. And so when you go to that middle position, it's balanced just right with those 57 classics. So it's really got a very bluesy sound, very spanky, you know.
That's
it's
awesome.
It's real spanky sounding guitar. So it's really cool. It's got an apex kind of pyramid on the back of the headstock, so that, you know, where the Gibsons usually, some of them, if you travel with them, if you fly with them, if you drop a Les Paul, it'll pop right there at the back of the stock. This has got an apex headstock thing that really protect that, which is good for guys like me that have to throw them in a gig bag and get on a plane and fly with it. So it's really cool, man. So and a good friend of mine, that actually, Bonamassa actually got a job got him hired. He was a good friend of ours from Los Angeles. Bonamassa got him a job at the custom shop, and he's there, and he helped design it. So
cool.
Good friend of mine and Joe's helped design it. So, you know, real great young guitar player, great guy named Matt Kohler. He's a real good friend of mine and Joe's, and he kind of led the way with the helping design the guitar. And it's really, really solid guitar. It's really cool. Eric Johnson got a gold top. I think Charlie Sexton got a gold
top.
That's
interesting. I have not even seen it.
So they got them. So yeah, they've got, and I got a sunburst one. So I got the sunburst one. I think Charlie and Eric got gold tops. So it's cool, man. It is a really cool guitar. Like I said, some guys look at it and go, I don't know, man, but it's really cool. The bottom horn of it is like a Les Paul Special kind of shape, and then the other longer, the upper bowels kind of a longer kind of cutaway design. Some guys have kind of compared them to Paul's guitars, but it's a totally different thing, man. It's completely different. You know, it's a completely different animal. It has a signature Gibson thing. Like I said, it's a cross between a Les Paul and an SG, kind of, you know, real spanky. But yet you get that big power of a mahogany guitar with a maple cap, you know. So I'll be taking it out this year, playing a lot.
Hey, let me tell you anything. If Gibson ever questions your, like, the deserving to be a rep, just play this interview, man. And I know that's not why you're doing it, but I'm saying, though, if they ever do, just play this interview. You couldn't find a better freaking rep than you, man. Hey, I'm going to ask you three more questions, Lance. I really appreciate your time. You've been a great, real pleasure. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
Something that they would find out.
Odd or be surprised to hear.
Man, you know, I will watch a chick flick with my girl.
Good for you, man. But you know what, though? Yeah, I've learned after being married 25 years, you have to do that, you know? Women...
They're like, man, there's no way Lance will watch that movie. I'm like, and I tell my wife all the time, if you tell anybody that I'm watching a movie with you, I will lie.
Oh, man, good for you.
Over here with me, it's spaghetti westerns or... You know, I go from spaghetti westerns to aliens, man. So,
an occasional chick flick.
In between all the big kind of guy movies. So, you know, but I will, like, okay, we can put on, you know, we can put on the chick flick now. The coast is clear.
What's it called?
Not
51st Dates. What's the other one with Kate Hudson? My wife watches all the time. I don't know. Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Man, cooking.
Oh, that's cool. What kind of stuff you like to cook?
I cook everything, man. Everything. It's one of my passions. I do all the cooking here in our home. I cook for my family.
That's awesome.
You know, so yeah, cooking is a big one. I've got a lot of friends that are well-known chefs. you know, we, and I get a lot of tips from those guys, and I go to the same place I go to when I'm playing guitar. You know, it's that kind of creative, inspired kind of thing. So I like to cook for my family and cook on holidays like I said, cook for my wife, and I do a majority of the cooking for our family. So yeah, cooking is a big, and I like to, you know, when I go to different parts of the world or different regions, I not only try the food, but I also learn how to make it so that I kind of bring that back. And, you know,
that's very cool, man. Very cool. Yeah. Last question, man. What has been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years?
Oh, man. I can see straight.
Bing.
Yeah, it kind of helps when I can see straight. I'm not seeing five of everything everywhere I look. You know, seeing, and it's like everybody says, man, you see it in double. I was seeing in quintuplet. Just definitely sobriety has definitely changed my whole perspective and outlook and appreciation, and created an insurmountable amount of gratitude, man, that I just, you know, that I never had before, and just appreciation for life and for everything in general, man, and just humility, you know, and gratitude, you know. So those have been some big, some monumental changes, and you know, so
awesome. It's been quite cool. Listen, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. You're a real hell of a nice guy, and I'm glad I got your backstory, because now I could appreciate you even more when I'm listening to you. And I hope you come down here to my area soon.
We should be, man. 2018, we should be down there. 2018-19, we're planning some big stuff for next year, so we will be touring a lot. So great. Be on the lookout. We will be around.
Good. You come down here, we'll hang. We'll have a cigar. Take you back absolutely to Ybor. Cigar and coffee. Nice boring afternoon. Hey, let me tell everybody, first of all, it's Lance Lopez. He's a phenomenal blues guitar player, and he's very emotional in his playing, very expressive in these, quite frankly, on fire, a lot of his songs. And if you're a guitarist, you have to check him out. And if you're just a blues enthusiast, you have to check him out. Let me tell you where the last album that came out was called Live in New York City. And then there's another album that came out called Rockin' the Blues. Rockin' the Blues is on the Mascot label. Is that correct, Lance?
That's correct. Yeah. And get it through the Mascot label group website, I believe, right now.
The Mascot label group website. And rumor has it, another album will be coming out in the spring. And we certainly hope so. As far as finding Lance on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, he's either at Lance Lopez Music or Lance Lopez Band. Did I get that right?
Yeah, the Facebook page is Lance Lopez Band. The website is LanceLopezMusic.com.
Right, okay.
And Twitter and Instagram, it's Lance Lopez TX.
Awesome. So Twitter and Instagram, Lance Lopez TX, Facebook, Lance Lopez Band, and then check him out on his website. Sign up to find out tour information at Lance Lopez Music. Hey, man, any final parting words?
Man, just Craig, I really appreciate you having me on your show. And, man, you know, I just look forward to seeing all you guys out on the road in 2018.
Awesome, man. Hey, hang on here while I say goodbye. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed learning as much about Lance Lopez as I did. He's a super interesting cat and tremendous player. Lance, thank you again. You've been super generous with your time, and I really appreciate you being so open and sharing all the backstory about you. And it was really nice to hear that. Everybody, go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with some cool stuff for guitar players. Now, be nice, go play your guitar, and most important, have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music. Thank you.